countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society. And it is Saturday once again, the 30th of March in the glorious future year of 2024. If there's anything you want to get done before the end of the month, you only have a little time. More time than you would have this point in February, however. Thank the divine Julius and his successor, the divine Augustus, for that. Anyhow. Of course, tomorrow, Sunday the 31st of March, in this year, falls Western Christians celebrate as the Feast of Easter. I'm not quite sure what the Eastern Orthodox are doing this year. But presumably, since they're Eastern Orthodox, you'd think that they would celebrate more Easter than Westerners, but as a matter of fact, they celebrate Pascha instead. Now, what else is there to know? So for those of you who follow my other show, I did do a live video stream of All Men Are Brothers, which is the 1930s Pearl S. Buck translation of the classic Chinese novel The Water Margin, on Tubnik's last Sunday, even though it was Palm Sunday. I do not intend to do one this coming Sunday, which is today, tomorrow, but I think I'm going to do one on Easter Monday. And that is only mildly motivated by the fact that I went to the store yesterday and bought a bunch of new soft drinks. I've got original flavor Ramune, I've got Sprecher's cherry soda, I've got Gale's root beer, and I've got something which claims to be a non-alcoholic mojito, so it should be basically like a mint limeade. Anyway, that's all by the way. What do I actually have to talk about today? Well, several things. I have one reader who will be... one listener, rather. Who will be gratified to know that the Wall Street Journal does have a story on the front page today about how those LED headlamps on cars are just too darn bright and they'll blind you and you might drive off the road, so they constitute a safety hazard rather than a safety device. It's a pretty obvious idea, but, the Wall Street Journal has got hold of it, which means that people who, you know, are in charge of making purchasing decisions might actually do something about it. Who knows? Who knows? Actually, I did buy a different soft drink, which is called Worm Juice, but I was taken out to the car and I accidentally dropped the bottle on the pavement and shattered it, and Worm Juice went everywhere. I still don't know. Maybe I'll go Monday and try to get another bottle of it, just, you know, to try it. It's probably not half as disgusting as they make it sound. Probably. If it is, you could just call me Wad Dib. Now, important note here, I did get the printer cartridge. It came much faster than I expected, only the second day after I ordered it, when they were telling me, you know, April 5th, April 7th, when I ordered it. So I'm very pleased by that. I have not yet got the revised graphics. F. Fogg, if you're listening to this, I'm waiting on the revised graphics. It's all down to you, man. As soon as you get me those, I can start making copies of Blast Number 1 for real. I actually sent out, the other day, a sample copy with the color-printed jacket on it, but with the, interior pages, which still have the slightly tatty graphics that I made up as placeholders, in the hopes that someone else would make better graphics. So, anyway, production version copies of Blast Number 1 should be going out soon. First and foremost, of course, by mail to my Patreon supporters. And then to various places. I'm thinking of sending one to the local public radio station. They've got a talk and interview program that's locally originated, and they might be interested in, talking to me, perhaps. whether it would be worth, you know, but you can't, you're right, you don't get anything if you don't try for it. So it's worth trying for, just in case I'm able to reach some people with a message of reason. Messages of reason, yes, I come to bring you messages of reason. Here's an interesting one for you. Iceland. Now, a friend and I are planning a European tour this fall, which will involve the use of the Ural Pass. And as a last act, we're planning on taking the ferry from Denmark to Iceland, and then by air travel from Iceland back to the USA, in time to vote in the election, assuming that it actually gets held. In Texas right now, God knows. We have the governor issuing proclamations that anyone who says, you know, that what's going on in Palestine is genocide should be expelled from any state university. We've got Ken Paxton, our attorney general, who has just plea bargained on his securities fraud indictment. Ken Paxton demanding, he's claiming he's going to investigate Spirit AeroSystems, the fuselage manufacturer in Wichita, Kansas, that Boeing spun off 20 years ago and is now looking to reacquire because they realize they actually need to be able to manufacture airplanes. You wouldn't think that. You know, they're Boeing. They can just sell airplanes without ever delivering them, right? And people will probably be happier considering what they've gotten when they actually have delivered airplanes recently. But that's another story, a story for another day, a story for a gentler and simpler time, perhaps. Anyhow, but he's trying to prove that diversity and inclusion have resulted in a failure of manufacturing quality, which, as I've said, is every bit as ridiculous as the guy who was claiming that Google's hiring practices, oh, well, you're hiring too many women and too many non-whites. You know, statistically, they just don't have the smarts. And it's like, statistics don't matter in this case. If you're Google, you could just cherry-pick the outliers. Same with aviation manufacturing. You can just cherry-pick the outliers. It doesn't matter what the statistical distribution looks like. Jesus Christ. So yeah, even if it were true, right, that some groups of people are better at building airplanes than others, the aviation industry doesn't have to take people at random from the general population. That should be obvious, but it's not obvious to someone like Ken Paxton. Because his career is based around not perceiving the obvious. And hoping that other people don't perceive the obvious, such as that he is a criminal, who uses the Office of State Attorney General to insulate himself from prosecution. Anyway, but that's enough about depressing Texas politics. We're talking about going to Iceland, and the problem, of course, is the ferry that goes from Hirtshals, Denmark, via the Faroe Islands to Iceland, fetches up on the east side of the island at a place called Seyðisfjörður. And I know I'm butchering the pronunciation. Anyway, and from there you somehow have to get to Reykjavik. There's three basic methods. One is you can take a city bus for 15 hours that costs you about $200. Yeah. And the second is you can take local air transport, and the third is you can rent a car. Now, my friend was looking at this, and she says, you know, because of this ferry that lands here and various other ships that land here, a lot of cargo is landed at Seyðisfjörður on the east side of the island, and then it's trucked along the Northern Ring Road from Seyðisfjörður to Eyrarbakki, which is the second largest town on the island, not really a city, but a sizable town, to Reykjavik. And as we've mentioned on the show before, Iceland consumes far and away more electricity per inhabitant than any other country. Consumes four times what the USA consumes, twice what Norway consumes, and yet still consumes a lot of fossil fuels. What are these fossil fuels used for? Well, a lot of the fossil fuel, of course, is used for heating, right, because Reykjavik and presumably Eyrarbakki and some of the other towns have geothermal heating systems because there are hot springs all over the darn place. But if your house doesn't have to be located right on top of one, you may have an oil burning or propane heat system in your home. But the other thing they import, and lots of it, is motor fuel, because it's a small and sparsely populated country. But here's the thing. It's a small and sparsely populated country where most of the roads aren't paved because of the, A, relatively light use, and B, the frost heaves. My God, the frost heaves. Now, my point of view here is that Iceland is a country which could very much benefit by building a railway. Now, they've been talking for years about building a train to take passengers back and forth between the Reykjavik City Airport, which is where the domestic air flights from other parts of Iceland fetch up, and Keflavik Airport, which is the international. Right, and it would also bring people into the city of Reykjavik, which they really want you to do. If you fly through Keflavik, they will offer you lots of inducements to stay over for a night and stay in a hotel in Reykjavik and see a little bit of Iceland. Even stay over two nights, you know. That may be a nice tour package. Not unlike what Turkish Airlines does with Istanbul. Anyway, but they want to bring the foreign exchange in the country. Anyhow, but it would be very, very useful for them to have this. It would also be very useful for them to have electric-powered transportation at the airport, which currently is all diesel buses, because, again, they have to import all that motor fuel. Anyway, but if they really are trucking large amounts of freight from Seyðisfjörður along the northern half of the Ring Road to Reykjavik, then it stands to reason that they could build a railway in parallel with that, an electrified railway, and eliminate all of that fossil fuel use, right? Because it costs money to import the fuel to drive those trucks around. It also costs a lot of money to maintain the roads after the trucks have been driving on them. So, what is Iceland's number one natural resource? Probably rocks. What is Iceland's number two natural resource? Probably volcanic rock. And what's Iceland's number three natural resource? Hydropower. They've got lots of electricity. They've got lots of rock. Two out of the three things you need for an electrified railway, right? So we crush up a bunch of rock to make ballast, and it goes mostly alongside the ring road, probably. Right, we have to import the rails. We have to import the standards that hold the overhead wire. We have to import the overhead wire, probably. And some Portland cement. And some hardware. And that's about it, because we use concrete cross ties. Now, you crush up basalt, and you have some sand and so on. You can get all the aggregate locally, all right, for the concrete. That's reasonable. What you may not know, although I've talked about it from time to time, is that basalt rock, volcanic rock, can be cast into fiber. I mean, it can be cast into shapes. It can also be drawn into fiber. This is very, very interesting for lunar industry, because the fiber and cast shapes and so forth have a lot of applications. The basalt is used in laboratory sinks and countertops, for example, in a cast massive form, because it's very resistant to chemical attack and abrasion. Anyway, but it can also, the fibers can be used to reinforce concrete. The Monolithic Domes Institute south of Dallas does this. Anyway, the fibers can be used to reinforce concrete, which means you can make concrete cross ties without having to import reinforcing steel. That's a big deal. And you can probably get away with using chopped basalt fiber for, in place of reinforcing steel, in the foundations for the pylons that hold the overhead wire. And in fact, you may be able to cast the overhead wire pylons themselves. The pylons, not the arms probably, but the pylons, out of concrete. I've seen lots of concrete lamp posts in the last few years. Definitely can be done, which means a maximum of local materials and a minimum of imports. And again, it reduces the cost of road maintenance by a substantial fraction, possibly as much as half. And you run a few passenger trains and freight trains every day. It needs mostly single track with a little yard at Eyjafjallajökull halfway along, some passing sidings, a yard at Seyðisfjörður, and a yard at Reykjavik. And you've taken a substantial fraction, possibly as much as a third of the truck traffic in the entire country off the roadways, and eliminated the need for a decent-sized chunk of the fossil fuel imports. This sounds like a really good idea to me. And again, the friend I was planning this trip with said, you know, the World Bank ought to finance this, or somebody ought to finance this, as a demonstration, the European Union maybe, as a demonstration project demonstrating decarbonizing transportation in an economy. Because the thing is that, yes, Iceland is a very rural country, right? It's not an ideal place for railway, except that it has a port on one side of the island, a population center on the other side of the island, and a lot of truck traffic going back and forth between them. That's a perfect case for a special purpose railway. And the fact that it would pass through or by Eyjafjallajökull, which is the second largest population center on the island, in the process, right, that picks you up a lot of additional benefit. Anyway, so that's, you know, so that's my proposal for Iceland. Now, I was reading this book, I think I mentioned it to you, Energy in the Service of Man, by Philip Sporn, and he was talking about, you know, the main thesis of his work, essentially, of this particular work, is essentially that energy by itself doesn't lead to industrialization, social development, and so on, and particularly not energy in the form of large central station electric power plants, which is why nuclear energy, when it was introduced, failed to set off a development revolution in the poorer countries of the world. And what he says, essentially, and this is from somebody whose background is in producing electric power, so he knows whereof he speaks, that the equipment for using the electricity has to be installed before you switch the power on, because generating power is of no value unless you have something to consume it. But he goes a step further and says something really intriguing, which is true from his point of view as an electrical engineer, which he was before he became a utility executive, but which sounds like absolute bizarreness. It sounds like a Zen koan, that electricity is the only commodity which must be consumed before it is produced. Well, what is he talking about? Well, what he really means is, if you have a large interconnected alternating current system with synchronous generators, right, all connected together, they are spinning, and they're producing a combination of what's called real power and reactive power. Anyway, what's important is that they don't generate any real power unless there's a load on the bus bars. So you have your system, there's motors and lights and everything on, all working away, and you attach another motor. You start a synchronous motor, right? You have to set it in motion. It begins drawing current. And as it begins to draw current, that just very, the load just causes the whole grid to slow down very, very slightly, which means that all the rotating machines, not only the generators, but also the other motors on the system, they contribute their inertia into the motor fields, and that generates the current that energizes the motor that you just set in motion. In other words, the current that you're drawing is generated because you started the motor. The motor doesn't start because you generated the current. Anyway, this is such a fascinating idea. It's of, as I say, no real value or utility except from the electrical engineer's perspective. But it does show you that, I don't know, I think of it as a facet of the beauty of engineering, that you can have something as absurd as a commodity that has to be consumed before it can be produced. That it's the addition of the motor load to the system that slows down the generator armature just that tiny fraction, that causes its inertia, the kinetic energy stored in its inertia, to be dumped into the electromagnetic field, which then feeds the bus bars, which then turns the motor that you just set in motion. Anyway, so that's a thought that I was having, which just entertained me enormously. Although it might make you think I'm a complete lunatic, there's nothing new in that. I did, after all, appear in the movie entitled Lunarsea. I have the largest role in it. And if you want to see it, the easiest way is probably to ask me for a copy. But, other than that, Quinton says, now do peak load calculations. I can't do them over the radio. I can't do them over speech. You've got to look at the load curve. I do know how to draw annual load curve graphs, though. I have a book on the topic. Well, not a book on that topic specifically, but I've got a couple of really good books on electrical engineering from the 40s, which have nomographs for stuff like the loads that streetcars, you know, how fast a streetcar goes between two points, assuming its top speed and its acceleration, things like that. Anyway, and they do teach you how to draw annualized load curves. Anyway, but that's not important in the current context. What is important, I want to talk to you a minute about a phenomenon that I observe all around me in many different ways, and that is quite disturbing. Now, it's sort of brought to mind, of course, this is the Easter season. There's the Feast of Corpus Christi has a particular liturgical prayer known as the Sequens Laudation, and one of the passages in it, done into English, says, let's see, here beneath these signs are hidden priceless things to sense forbidden signs, not things, are all we see. And I think about that a lot, because there are many, many people in the world around us who seem to live in a world of signs rather than in a world of things signified, or at least they try to. And this takes an enormous number of different guises. Obviously, the people who read the Wall Street Journal are very, very bad about this, because they think of the economy, they don't think of goods and services changing hands, right? They think of money, and they don't even think of money, they think of the quotations in the stock market, they think of the index of leading economic indicators, they think of the consumer price index and the producer price index, they think of the conference board's consumer confidence statistics, right? They think of all these things which are abstractions. They're meant to be signifiers to tell you something about the underlying real economy, the world, that is to say, in which things are given from one person to another in exchange for other things, in exchange for actions, and so on. Because that's what an economy really is, right? You've got production, you've got consumption, and you've got exchange. Now, exchange itself is a little bit of an abstraction from production and consumption. But the people who read the Wall Street Journal are interested only in abstractions from exchange. And then in abstractions from the abstractions from exchange and so on. And that's why I think they can believe that an increased number of billionaires in a country means that the country is prosperous. Right, because they see billionaires existing as a signifier of prosperity. Right, they're not looking at the thing. They're not looking at the facts about the thing. They're not looking at the reality of the thing. They're looking, and the thing becomes to them a sign. Whatever it is in itself is irrelevant. Quentin says, I bet that's a great book, and it really is. But it's not unique to them, not in any way, shape, or form. My God, you go on the internet for a moment, and you realize that it's everywhere. You know, I mean, you have, of course, a substantial chunk of the, you know, substantial political faction in my country right now, which is utterly incapable of seeing things as things, and has instead created some extremely bizarre papier-mâché signifiers out of real things which are not anything like or even in any way connected to what they are trying to signify. And, you know, you get these, I mean, QAnon people who are saying that there was, you know, some kind of secret plot that collapsed the Francis Scott Key Bridge. The fact that a ship, a 100,000-ton cargo ship, rammed one of the bridge supports, well, that couldn't have caused a bridge to fall down any more than airplanes flying into them could have caused the World Trade Center towers to fall down. Every one of these people is a self-appointed structural engineering expert, and they're exactly the same quality as the guy who said, well, Nibiru was supposed to pass the Earth and cause the poles to flip upside down, causing the oceans to rise and drown everybody, but it didn't happen. The physics all worked out, which just shows he knows nothing about astrophysics. And so it's clear that we've all been duped. The globe Earth theory is wrong. It's a flat Earth, and I'm going to Antarctica so that I can then strike out across Antarctica, cross the wall into the outer world, which they've hidden from us. you know, this is, in some way or other, yeah, it is, you know, the rule number one of Korzybski's general semantics is the map is not the territory. And many people are confused, not only conflating, but completely confusing and inverting the two. And you see this in many, many ways and manifestations. You know, you've got the people who, you know, if you see a man with a broken leg, would you say that it's better to splint his leg, or would you say that it's better to develop an elaborate theory of leg brokenism, according to which it's, you know, patriarchal and colonialistic social mores which cause the exclusion of people with broken legs from square dances and marathons and soccer matches and kickboxing tournaments, and that what we need is to recognize that it's normal to have a broken leg, and that splinting broken legs is a eugenicist practice which we all ought to abhor. And yet, in many ways, there are people out there who are absolutely convinced that they are breaking new frontiers in social justice by coming up with ideas that aren't any more reasonable than that, and in fact sound a great deal like that. And why is that? Again, I think it's because, to a great extent, social justice to them is a signifier, and other people are signifiers. They forget that social justice can only be seen in what happens to individuals. To me, that's of the utmost importance. Whether or not a society is just can only be seen from what happens to the people in it. If people are getting thrown in jail, if people are getting stopped at border crossings and so on, it's probably not that just of a society. You can't just elaborate theory that doesn't account for what's really happening with people. Theory should be a guide, should be abstracted from experience as a, you know, but never disconnected from it. And that's what happens when you confuse signifiers with the things signified. And this, I believe, is where a lot of the opposition to nuclear energy comes in. And particularly people talk about nuclear waste. Now, as I was told when by an older green in a climate march in Munich, when I tried to say the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, right, the highest world scientific authority on climate change, says explicitly that nuclear has the lowest equivalent life cycle greenhouse gas emissions per unit of energy produced. And he says those may be the facts, but the facts don't matter. Why? Because nuclear energy is not seen as a thing. If you see a thing, you may be interested to know the facts about it. The facts about it might be important to you. But if you see it as a signifier, as a sign, sign of what? Maybe of an industrial society you don't trust? Who knows? You're right, maybe of superpower confrontation. Who knows? If you see it as a signifier rather than a thing, you're not going to be interested in the facts about it. As I've often said, the facts about nuclear waste make you think, hey, this is actually a lot less bad than most other industrial wastes. Much easier to manage, smaller in quantity, it goes away if you leave it long enough. But people often say to me, how could you possibly justify creating any more nuclear waste on this planet of ours? And the reason is, to them, nuclear waste is a signifier. It is not a thing. The facts about it do not matter. And so, to the greatest possible extent, I would say, the mission of those of us who would advocate for nuclear energy is first and foremost to get people to see nuclear energy as a thing. Now, space development is a bit more complex a problem in that way. But nuclear energy, if it's a signifier for me, it's a signifier for hope, right? For science applied in the service of man. And I think a lot of emphasis has been laid on that, but many people don't believe in that anymore. So we have to get them first to treat it as a thing.
X5.